with the Serenity Prayer after a moment of silent meditation. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Before I get into reading the few things that we have to read here, I am a part of this committee. I was almost left out, but yesterday I got recognized. Some people wonder what my job is. Now, I've appointed myself to this position because nobody would appoint me to it. I'm in charge of public relations. I have tried to shake everybody's hand in this room. If I haven't, I apologize. Because you people are the one who made this conference, not what this committee did. Just by you showing up and coming here to join us, it's your conference. Come back next year. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. This morning I have a young man here that I've known 6 or 8 months who came to our island from somewhere in Florida. And I've asked him to read how it works. Walter.
I'm Walt Davis, an alcoholic, and it's wonderful to be here.
Hey, Walt.
I never knew I'd be on a head table before. This is what you get from moving from Florida to Hilton Head. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
I don't know how I'm going to introduce this speaker. I've learned a little more about him. I was very fortunate about 2 years ago to go to Shreveport, Louisiana, and that's the first place that I met Father Hillary. I enjoyed him. He's a great man, a great person, a great individual. And then last year, I was invited up in Kentucky to a little conference, and when I get there, who's there but Father Hillary? Again, we had a great conference, a great time together. So when he come together to put this program together, I said, I'm going to try to ask Father Hillary to come here. And I did. And he's just a great person. You know, we were talking yesterday morning at breakfast. This is where your AA is in these rooms talking to people that you've never seen or heard of before. And they'll tell you little things about them that you wouldn't, you know, that you wouldn't expect. But he talked about his progress in AA, you know. He talked about progress in his life. And then this morning at breakfast, we talked about playing blackjack and 21. He loves to do that. Do you know who else loves to play blackjack and 21? I do. So we have something in common, plus being alcoholics. I can't tell you enough about this person, because I really don't know a lot about him, except I know he's a great person, and I love him. Father Hillary.
Somewhere it says that what the alcoholic has got to have is ego reduction in depth. And what I just heard is not inclined to do that for me. So I'll have to disregard it as being kindly meant, but very bad for me. My name is Hillary Draper, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Good morning. Before I forget my manners, let me thank the committee and Hollis and Mary and anybody who had anything to do with getting me up here. I sure am pleased to come. What a magnificent place. I couldn't help it. I got some... Many of you have heard this story, but it's true. In Cullman, we were allowed to take the suffering alcoholic out of the jail and take him to the meetings. And we were getting one little man out who was from the Red Hills of North Alabama. And his wife, I better give the name, called him Bob and called her Mary. She would come, and turned out she also belonged. And my sponsor, Juby, was the sales manager of the Ford Company. And one night we were going in a great big... Lincoln, you know, one of those demonstrators, to Birmingham to a meeting. There was Juby and myself, another priest, and this little couple and another lady in the back. Conversation waned. There was silence for a while, and then this lady, Mary, says in this little bitty voice, she says, well, as I says to Bobby, Look what we's drinked ourselves into. High-class society and a great big automobile. There was this dreadful silence in the car. I didn't know what to say, you know. And finally, my sponsor, Juvie, says, "Well, Mary, honey, we all thanks you, but it ain't nothing really but a car full of drunks." And when Hollis tooled me up in that great big automobile to the marquee out here, you know, I thought, Lord, look what we has drinked ourselves into. High-class society and a great big automobile. Gee, I got to say, you all are high-class drunks on Hilton Head. But you know, while we do enjoy the facility, what Hollis says is true. What I've enjoyed the most is people, all of you all. So I am real, real grateful for being here. I've just got one more little thing to get off. I used to stand up and say, "My name is Father Hillary, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic." And one of my sponsors got a hold of me some time ago and said, "Yeah, there you are, going around, standing up, saying your name is Father Hillary, like you something." So you better stand up and say your name is Hillary Drakeman. You ain't nothing but a drunk. I had a lot of trouble with that first step. But I thought about it, and I decided he was right, so I don't do that. I stand up and I say, "My name is Hillary Draper, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And it is because of a merciful higher power whom I choose to call God, and practicing the principles of this blessed program in all of my affairs at any time with people not just like you, many of you, that Hillary Draper, the drunk, is able to take on the role of Father Hillary, the priest. And for that, I'm everlastingly grateful." There's just one other little remark. I think you ought to know this. I was very pleased to come, but somebody sent CCW a flyer from this conference, and CCW has brought along with him 16 people paying customers to this conference, and mostly because I'm here. I couldn't resist that, but many of CC, he knows, have been instrumental in my sobriety, and I think they just came to make sure that I'm still sober, you know, and that's good, too. All right, here we go. It's right now about, we'll say, 10:30. It's not quite, but what you're going to get is 15 minutes of what I was like, 15 minutes of what happened, 15 minutes of what I'm like now, and 5 minutes of commercials, and with 5 minutes introductions will be done. So at 10:45, you're going to get what happened. Here we go. I have heard so many alcoholics say that they were born at a very early age in a good Christian home that I'm not sure that's anywhere as to raise children anymore. But at any rate, I was born at a very early age in a good Christian home, and that Christian home was Mobile, Alabama, and it was a Catholic home. And we did not think that it was morally wrong to drink in moderation. Make no doubt about it. Catholics think drunkenness is seriously morally wrong, just like the Baptists and some of the Methodists do. But I learned to rhyme when I guess I was 8 or 9 years old. Went like this: "Wherever a Catholic sun doth shine, there's sure to be laughter and good red wine. At least I've always found it so, Benedicamus Domino." That's Chesterton, in case you don't know it. And I can't say that we drank every day in my home. We didn't. But it was there. Feast days, company, great occasions, it was there. It was part and parcel of our life. If it could be said of anybody that had a training in how to drink like a gentleman, it should have been me. I don't know when I got my first drink. I really don't. There is a Jewish dentist of our persuasion, a great friend of mine over in Dallas, Texas. He says he got it when he was circumcised. He may have beat me by a few days. that's foolishness. But it's meant to show that as kids, a small glass with a little bitty wine in it, cold water, just like the big people, just like the big people. Alcohol was, I know this, that from the time I could realize what was happening, I loved it. I really did. And I don't know, I was listening last night to our friend C. Conway and hearing what he was saying. I don't know that I was born. I've heard people say they couldn't stand the taste of it. I loved the taste of it. I really, it says in the big book we drank because we liked the effect of drinking. And early on, I learned that it could do something for me. I was not a great athlete. I wanted to be. I was a good student. But I was always, I was a people pleaser. I found that out. I resented God very bitterly. My father had died when I was 4 years old. I understood what Conway was saying last night about the relationship with his father because I never had it. And I know today that I had a marvelous grandfather who was the male image in my life. But it wasn't the same. It wasn't the same at all. I used to wonder why I was an alcoholic. And after I'd been in AA at the Noble Group at Cullman, Alabama, with the master teachers, 2 years I've been in the program dry on a closed meeting night, I asked them. I said, what am I doing, an alcoholic? Me, with my splendid aristocratic background, degenerate southern aristocracy, with my splendid Catholic upbringing, with my marvelous education and degrees and college. I identified with that thermometer, too. But anyhow, I said, and me, you know, an ordained minister, an eminent divine, at least to the second Walter, what am I doing, an alcoholic? And, of course, the great silence comes over the group, you know. When everybody knows the answer and they're waiting to see he's going to zap the food, you've found it, you know. And Juby comes up, my sponsor, and he says, well, Father, it don't make no difference how the jackass got into the ditch. Just get him out. Gee, you know, the tremendous wisdom of AA. I'm serious about that. It doesn't make one bit of difference how this jackass got into the ditch. Get him out. And AA has let this jackass out of the ditch today. For that, I'll be everlastingly grateful. This towering ego, managing, I see all of that in me. I'm growing up, a consummate liar. Notice I said I was raised in a good Christian home. But I don't know why I would lie. We weren't trained to do that. But I was the kind that if the train missed me by 50 feet, by the time I told you, it'd be 5 feet. I always wanted to look better than I really was. You see, always playing a role. At the age of 16, my mother, because of my father's death, felt that I needed more men in my education, and she sold me up the river to the tender mercies of the Benedictine monks at Cullman, and I never got away. But mind you, in those far-off halcyon days, I got in with the families of my classmates. Every housewife worth the name in Cullman knew how to squeeze that grape and make that German-type grape juice, only they did it with Cullman County strawberries. And if you all haven't tasted Cullman County strawberry wine before you got in AA, it's just too late. The most gorgeous color red I ever saw in my life. An aroma, when you took the cork out, you could smell it in the next block. A kick like you just have to wait till you get to him. That's all. But again, no trouble. You're with somebody's family, a small glass, homemade piece of cake. Lovely. 41, I love St. Bernard. I love the monks so much, I wanted to be part and parcel. I said, can I join? They said, you can try. And in 41, I took the veil. And guess what? I discovered that the monks were not about to be outdone by the housewives of Cullman. And they, too, knew how to squeeze that grape, make the German type grape. And they made a little homebrew on the side. Yeah. Now, I wouldn't want you to think there's 40 or 50 drunk monks at Cullman. There's not. There's me. The rest of them pretty normal. But, and you know, I can look at it today to say, looking back, the characteristics of the alcoholic. The first time I discovered that the monks had, you know, well, they call it in Latin, haustus. That's an hour after Vespers. They don't drink every day. On feast days, when they come together and homemade wine, homebrew, pink lemonade for the panty waists, you know, cigars, sandwiches. Beautiful. If you know the German word, Gemütlichkeit. That kind of thing. Perfectly innocent. But man, looking back, they say to me, how much did you drink? How much did you drink? How much did you drink? You know, from the time I was, 19 years old, I always drank as much as I could, as long as I could, whenever I could, as long as there was anything to drink. I never knew that, you know, you didn't see it every day in our house. And whenever you got it, it was a long time between drinks. So this is the truth. I hate to tell it. But from the time I was 19 years old, and, you know, you're still strong, hale hearted, I always drank as much as I could. I never, if I started drinking, the only way I would quit was if there was nothing else to drink or I was too sick to keep on drinking. Now, I don't like to admit that, but that's the way it was with me. Now, I didn't let people know I was sick. I'd get sick in private, you see, if I got sick for those first times. But there it is. You know, I look back and I see the alcoholic pattern there, you know, this disease pattern, this mental obsession tied up with this physical compulsion to drink. I was always the first one there, the last one to leave. We went to Kansas to study philosophy. The monks out there all belong to the WCTU, and they don't drink. That's crazy. They certainly do drink. It's hidden drinking out there, though. It's not accepted at all. And if I had to classify myself as a bedroom drinker, a barroom drinker, a hidden drinker, a closet drinker, I'd say I was a chicken house drinker. Because that's where they kept it in Kansas. And there's a lot more going on in the chicken house of North Alabama than right now than just laying eggs, I can tell you. Back to Cullman. We had a new abbot. They closed up the Stella. We're not manufacturing anymore. So the monks of Cullman are not drinking anymore. Want to bet? We tried that on a national scale, and it didn't work. You know that. Lord have mercy. And so I progress. You know, that doesn't mean you get better. For alcoholism, if you've crossed that invisible line, it means you're getting worse. Now, I don't know when I crossed the invisible line. I really don't know. I know when I suffered my first blackout. I was 19 years old, Christmas party, in a monastery. Now, believe me, you don't join monasteries to become drunks. You join monasteries as a special kind of Christian witness. But here I was experiencing what some people say is almost a Satan sign. You got it. Yeah. You know what a blackout is. I'm not going to bother explaining it. If you don't know, ask your sponsor. So I wouldn't admit to blackouts for 2 years after I was in the program. I was unique. I didn't have blackouts. I was a liar. I did have blackouts. True, yeah, but I don't know why I was so scared of admitting them. The first one I had at 19, I didn't know what it was. And the next morning, trying to understand, I never talked to anybody about it because I think way back in the back of my mind, I knew alcohol was connected with it. And I liked everything about alcohol so much, I didn't want anything bad to happen to me with regard to alcohol. I came to the astounding conclusion in my tremendous calibrated intelligence that it was the cheese. Isn't that stupid? You know? They say alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I say alcoholics are. We say alcoholics are con men. I think the person we con the worst is ourselves. Because for years, I at least acted as if I believed that. I was ordained a priest in 47. By 47, I'm sure that I've crossed that line. Again, I'm able to do a tremendous amount of work. I was associate principal in a fancy prep school we had. Alcohol's in the picture. These terrible personality clashes with the boss, I'm convinced that alcohol was the reason for them. You can't have personality clashes for many reasons, but with goodwill, you can clear them up, not if alcohol's in the picture. And because of the alcoholism, I get my first geographical cure removal. If you don't know what that is, ask your sponsor. I haven't got time today to explain all that. And I end up in the mountains of southeastern Kentucky, where Kentucky, Virginia, and Tennessee come together. The Cumberland Gap area in the 50s. President Johnson declared it was a disaster. I knew that when I got there. By this time, the boss and me weren't talking. We lived on the same hall, but he was writing me letters. Does that strike a familiar chord with any of y'all? And it said, go to Barberville. I said, where in the Lord's name is Barberville? Some wag of a monk says, you go to hell, turn left, walk 3 miles. He was wrong, you only go 2. But I tell you what happened, you know, it's an ill wind that doesn't blow some good. First morning I was up in those mountains, the priest I was replacing said, you eat your meals over at Aunt Sally Coon's house. That's next door. It's your house. Uncle Albert is a retired miner. He's a Catholic. He watches the property while you ride the circuits. and Sally belongs to the Lottie Moon Circle, but she feeds you when you're home. So we go over for breakfast. Hot September. And Sally's not a bit happy with the new priest. She's got the old one broken in nicely. She doesn't say a word. We sit down at the kitchen table. There's Uncle Albert, lovely man in his 60s. Here I am. Here's the other priest. Uncle Albert's son, a state trooper, about 35, only out of a pair of shorts. His two sons, 17, 18. Difficult conversation. Water tumbler filled up like that, beads on. I picked the thing up and took two great big swallows. Well, you all have seen the atomic bomb blasts. I couldn't breathe. My eyeballs turned over. My eardrums went in and out, you know. I was just roaring. I'm convinced today that if I hadn't been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder. But all I did was hold on tight till the tremors passed, you know. Now, that's the truth. And when that breakfast was over, that priest and I were stepping high over the weeds going back to... And I said to him, in the Lord's holy name, what was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He says, any time you can get it. Oh, Lord, have mercy. I haven't got time to tell you all that. It was awful. I'm going to stay on this schedule today. You're going to get what you came for. That's just one episode. And I'd say I didn't get in any trouble. Now, that's, again, that towering ego. That's a lie. I was there 5 years. I was a young man. I could, you know, you got some resiliency at that time. But I didn't do the job I could have done if I wasn't drinking. You know as well as I do that drinking takes time. If you're going to be a serious drinker, you've got to devote time to it. And you can always find another serious drinker who will be glad to do a little drinking with you anytime you want, especially if you've got the whiskey. But be that as it may, I'm back to the college 5 years later, dean of the college, but this time I'm hooked. I got to have it where I can see it, shake it, look at the frog eyes, read the labels. See all that peculiarity? Normal drinkers don't do that. I didn't have to drink it every day, but I had to have it there in case of snake bite. I want to celebrate Hungarian Freedom Fighters Day. And again, the pattern. Once I start, I don't quit. The terrible personality clashes, I get another geographical cure removal to the delta of the Mississippi. Now, if you don't know where that is, you're not going to get the whole time. I'll have to tell you real quick. If you think it's in southwest Louisiana, it isn't. It begins in the lobby of the old Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. It goes downriver 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, and you come to Yazoo City. And if you all think you know the South and you haven't been to the Delta, you don't know nothing. Those people don't know the Civil War was lost. They don't even know it was fought and couldn't care less. Long hot summers of the 60s. Lord have mercy. I thought I had come to paradise. Had so much trouble with the empty bottles. Oh, empty bottles. Every time I opened the closet, full of empty. I said, somebody's putting them in there. Here I was in Shaw, Mississippi, pick up the phone, say, Mamie. She said, be right there, Father. Now, Father Malachy tells me I tell you that story to be sure you understand Mamie's the bootlegger. You're a little slow this morning. Anyhow, Mamie would come, take the dead soldiers out, give them decent Christian burial, put in new recruits, send you a bill at the end of the month. Made in the shade. Except I was coming apart at the seams. The blackouts, the running fits, the not remembered, everything that happens to the alcoholic. And here I am, a priest, the place of the... It's terrible. It's just terrible. But that's not the end of it. Imagine... I get to be president of the college. We got a new chairman of the board from Minnesota, dumb as hell. I shouldn't say that because he turned out to be my savior. And I love him today more than I loved any man in the world. But he accepted a bid for me to be president of the college. And I got that bid. Look at the towering ego again. Anybody with my track record, because people were beginning to talk ugly about me, you know. The alcoholism was beginning to show. I'm losing automobiles, you know. Normal people don't lose automobiles. Where did you put the car? I don't know. It's not your car. It belongs to the church. It costs $7,000. Where in the car? I don't know. It's funny now. What a bit of fun then. Where's the car? I don't know. Oh. Well, in the heyday of my alcoholism, I used to have the shakes and the hot flashes. I don't shake anymore, but I still have the hot flashes. And when I tell you these stories, I'm going to have to quit that part. I came home as president of the college for 3 years. It was a glorious flop. The alcoholism is waste and waste. Finally, I get fired, literally fired, because I'm standing up in front of a group of important people giving a State of the Union message about the college, and I am drunk. And the last thing I remember, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm taking one more drink to steady my nerves. I'm giving that report at 8 o'clock at night, and as I tell you that, I really begin to shake, because I can realize what it must have meant to the Board of Trustees, the Board of Governors, the Student Governor Association, all the important people of that college, to be in the presence of the obviously drunken president and to have to sit there and try to listen to him stumble through a drunken report. Dear God in heaven. That did it. Literally, I was through. Within a few days, the chairman of the board called me and told me they had a meeting of the board, and I was fired. That they didn't want me. It was horrible. It was horrible. He didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. He told me I was an absolute disgrace to my own good name, that if my family knew what was happening, they would disown me, that I had driven them crazy in that monastery, and that they intended to put up with it no longer, to get away and get out. Now, the reason I'm not trying to overdraw things, but you have to realize that the two things that I had given my whole life to up to that time, namely the priesthood and that monastery at St. Bernard, were gone. And let me show you the insanity of alcoholism. After he finishes with me, and I walk out of his office, I go right downstairs to my room and have another drink to steady my nerves. Now, if that isn't insanity, I have just lost everything that means anything to me. As far as I know, you can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. It's gone. And what do? Right down there, another drink to steady my nerves. Shame. The old man had said one thing, though. He said, I wish you'd go somewheres and get some help with your drinking problem. Doesn't know the word alcoholism. He said, you cannot stay here. I'll try to help you get a job. You're a good teacher. Anyways, in the country. But what I wish you'd do is go someplace. I agreed. I said I would go someplace and try to get some help. That's what happened. And, you know, I'm convinced today that if I hadn't been able to say, yes, I'll go someplace, get some help, I'd either be crazy or dead today. I wouldn't be standing here. I could not have stood the burden of guilt. I'd have kept right on drinking. The man had heard of a place called Hazelden up in Minnesota who did something good for people who were bad to drink. And I got sent to Hazelden. I didn't know what they did. I know where they cut something out of you, where they stuffed something up in you, where they blew in your ears. I didn't know what they did. I really didn't. First morning I'm there. Took me to the counselor and said, now, Father, hear it. That's the last time I called you Father, because you ain't nothing but a drunk. Yvonne, did you notice how I cleaned that up? They talk so ugly up there. It was offensive to my pious ears. But again, look at the towering ego. He said, take off that collar. You've got no right to wear it. You're not in good standing in the priesthood. There I was, dressed up, you know, ready to go. Next starts the deflation of the ego. So last time we called you Father, you ain't nothing but a drunk. Ooh, I resented that. At that time, it was a 3 weeks program. And they said, and secondly, don't plan on 3 weeks for this program. I said, I reckon I'll get it in 2. I did. And that man looked at me, he says, oh, no, no, no. He said, we discover that it takes 3 and 4 times for people like doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, undertakers, college professors, ministers to get this simple program. Just what, let's tell you about, you get that thermometer. Gee. They gave me the big book. That's not true. They sold it to me. They said, read it. The first thing I did when I got the big book, I looked inside to see if it had an imprimatur from a Catholic bishop. And it doesn't. And I said, huh, that's Probably printed in Nashville. Baptist literature for show. They're not going to brainwash me. I wouldn't read it. No. Wasn't that intelligent? Oh, boy. Now, notice the logic, because at the same time they sold me the little black 24-hour-a-day book. That didn't have any bishop's imprimatur in it. I love that. I read that every day. I wouldn't touch that thing. No. Well, they had a wonderful program up there. You had three meetings a day like this. They had a couple of closed meetings, and you had to go to the table three times a day, whether you could eat or not. And for the rest of the time, they didn't care what you did. You know, putting some discipline in my life. Lord have mercy. Well, I sat there, I guess it was long into the fifth week, and it became apparent to my cunning alcoholic brain that the people who were getting out of Hazelden were working step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it became further apparent to me that if I didn't take work do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I was going to be in Hazelden until Gabriel blew his horn. So I decided I want to stay that long. So the truth is, I did. I sat up one night and I read page 1 to 164. I did, the whole thing. I went back over it. I couldn't wait for breakfast to get over the next morning. Breakfast was over. I shot down to the counselor's office. I says, I got it. I got step 1. My life's unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol. He says, you ain't got nothing. Get back. I'm telling you the truth. I'm not exaggerating this. I says, I do got... He says, you are full of resentments. I said, I don't resent anything. And I believed it, you know. I was so full. I resented the bishop. I resented God. I resented the abbot. Oh, Lord. They kept me on step 1. I can't tell you how long, but I really don't believe that I got step 1 until I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous 2 years. I mean that. That I got it up here, but I didn't really get it down here, where action is a magic word, until I got to the master teachers at Colvin, Alabama, like Juby and Hoyt, those people who could really teach it to you. I'm not knocking what I got in the Hazelden. I'm glad I got it. I needed everything I could get. They finally, you know, just in desperation, said, well, I guess he's got some element of step 1. Step 2 was glorious. I loved that I had been insane. And I'm not going to give you some of the examples of insanity except one, that certainly this is insane. If you happen to come into the president of the college's office, and it's a beautiful mahogany, gorgeous drapes, and when you walk in the door, all you can see is two legs sticking up over the desk, that's insane behavior. The rest of the president is under the desk. He has fallen out of his presidential chair. And all you see is two legs sticking up. You know, that's insane behavior, really. That's enough. I got many others, but that's enough right there. Jail, Lord in heaven. Jail, you know, I forgot to tell you that. Yeah, I was in jail. I don't like to tell you that, but I was. I'm just horrible. Horrible. I remember waking up in jail and I thought, where am I? It's a funny bed I'm sleeping on. No mattress. No pillow. I opened my eyes and I said, bars at the window. I thought, oh, Lord, you have played hell this time. And the most horrible thing about that, the way that jail is constructed, I couldn't tell, looking out the window, whether I was in Mobile, Pensacola, New Orleans, Nashville, Birmingham or Rome, Italy. And I could have been in any one of them. Oh, Lord. But I tell you that because I don't think... My sponsor says the only difference between a high-bottom drunk and a low-bottom drunk is the high-bottom drunk has his head on the curb. And this disease will take every ounce of self-respect that you let it take. I mean, I remember the attitude of adoration before the commode. Anybody else remember that? Oh, boy. Oh. And when we get to laughing too much in our group at Coleman, and we laugh a lot, when we're laughing too much, Juby, my sponsor, will say, all right, let's not forget the vomit. Ooh, that brings my ego down in a hurry. That brings my ego down in a hurry. The third step, you know, that was a glorious reunion for me. The God that I had been given by tender, loving people was my Father. And I had walked away from Him. He hadn't walked away from me. And He loved me in my sickness as well as in my health. One of my sponsors tells me that he doesn't know a single alcoholic who doesn't have a problem in two areas. One, the God area, the other, the sex area. And I do know an awful lot of people who have trouble with step three. But I'd like to tell you something I read just recently about that that may help new people put it in proper perspective. Step three said, made a decision to turn our lives, our wills and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And God said, what an order. I can't go through with it. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Try it the next time you got the pigeons having trouble with the God idea. Step four, Satan and fearless moral inventory. I did it. Took it to the man. He says, oh, you've made another mistake. You took an immoral inventory. An immoral inventory. He says, it's moral. You're supposed to put the good and the bad. I said, I can't think of anything good. Look at the towering ego. He says, didn't you love your mother? I said, yes. He says, put it down. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and other human being the exact nature of our wrong. That wasn't hard for me. I'm a Catholic. I've been used to admitting to God when I was wrong, admitting to myself and to another human being. A priest in the black box of the confessional with a grill and a chitin, and if you change your voice, you can really be anonymous. But here AA says you do it eyeball to eyeball, and that do make a difference. In fact, those of you who are Catholic know the old church has learned something from AA. You can now take the sacrament of penance eyeball to eyeball. Learn something from AA. I did it. Now pay attention. I have just finished the fifth step. And that man said to me, now, Father Hillary, it was good to hear that. He says, if you really believed alcoholism is a disease, when you go back to Coleman, are you going to tell people you're an alcoholic? I said, of course not. That's the dumbest question I ever heard. I said, you don't know the South. We don't run around with a big sign, oh, watch out for me, I got tuberculosis. No, I'm not going to tell them I'm an alcoholic. And furthermore, you know, I can't go back to Coleman. He says, why can't you go back to Coleman? I says, you know why I can't go back to Coleman. He says, why can't you go back to Coleman? He says, well, you running around with women. I've just taken a fifth step. I said, no. He said, did you embezzle the college's money? I said, no. Now look again at the wisdom of AA. I couldn't see that. If I had been involved with women on the local scene, if I had embezzled the college's money, maybe I couldn't have gone back. You know, made amends to the people you can, except when to do so would injure them or others. But here AA says, you came out because of the disease of alcoholism. You go back and pick up the pieces. I said, all right, I'll go back. Now, you convinced the board of trustees to let me come back. I'm not the first priest in Alabama who ever had trouble with alcoholism. I do believe I'm the first one who ever got this blessed program of AA. But years ago, if we had a priest and he had the failing, as we call it, and we could send him to the sisters at St. Louis, up in Louisville, that was another big place we sent him, in New Orleans, get him somehow or another straightened out. We never let him return to the scene of the crime. We sent him to Texas, Utah, New Mexico. Go west, young man, go west. That's the truth. And here I told you the things I love the most were the priesthood and St. Bernard. They're both at Coleman. And I think I can never get back. And here's this blessed AA say, go back. And you know what? They convinced the Board of Trustees to let me come back. They convinced the Board of Trustees to let me come back. I'm telling you, I can't begin to tell you what that said to me. Well, that's what happened. Now I'm back at Coleman. I wish I could tell you that my return to Coleman was like the return of the prodigal son in the Bible. Y'all remember that? Kill the fatted calf, putting out the face robe, strike up the band, start the dancing. My son was dead, come to life, lost his family. Wasn't like that at all. Wasn't like that at all. If I had described what my return to Cullman was like, and you know, I can really understand. First of all, I used to say, and I think it was a little smart Ikey, I used to say in my talk that if ever I got into a position where I could read the minutes of the Board of Trustees, I was going to read the minutes of the day when the agenda said, shall we let Father Hilary return to Cullman? And I thought it was my... I want to tell you that today I keep the minutes of the Board of Trustees, all of them. And I could look up that date any time I wanted to. But you know what? You all have taught me how to grow. If I were to look that matter up and read it, it would serve no useful purpose and might injure some real fine people. And so you all have given me the strength of will, even though I've got them and could read them any time I want to. I've never read those minutes. I don't intend to. You all have taught me that it's useless. What difference does it make? It's gone. It's way back in the past. Forget it, stupid. But I can imagine the consternation when the abbot announces, the doctors and the counselors at Hazelden say we got to take Father Hilary home. Lord have mercy. I can just imagine, you know. Because they're human beings, too. And this, like the big book says, this tornado roaring through lives, upsetting gentle affairs. Can you imagine what a drunk is like in a monastery? Gee, how do you hide him, you know? Anyhow, if I had to tell you what my return to Cullman was like, I would have to say it was like two porcupines making love. You know how they make love? Carefully. I mean, I can remember little incidents. For example, one day I hadn't been home too long, and I had a great big old steamer trunk. And I was down on my hands and knees rooting through that steamer trunk looking for something, and somebody happened to come to my room and says, oh, my God, you're not back at it again. I raised up out of that trunk and was just highly indignant. There's several things I have to tell you. Now I'm in the last part. I don't understand what's happened to the time, but I've talked a half an hour. Now you got 15 minutes what I'm like now. Let me tell you what happened. When I left Cullman on... And my dry date is January the 14th, 1968. I got cashiered in December of 67. But as soon as they could get me up there, and I kept along drinking, January 14th, 68. And I got back to Cullman in September. Now, the only AA I'd had was what I got in the treatment center. And I did get into a priest's group up in Yankee Land because they wouldn't let me come home right away. Now, I enjoyed the priest group, but when I got back to Cullman in September, I looked up in the phone book, and I couldn't find AA listed. And so I came to the conclusion there was no AA in Cullman. And I stayed a loner from that end of August, 1st of September, until the next January. There was a priest who loved me very much, and he used to say to me, aren't you supposed to be going to some kind of meetings or something? I said, yeah, but they don't have them in Cullman. He said, well, surely they have them in Decatur. That's only 30 miles up the line. You can go. I said, I don't need them. We've spent all that money in Hazelden to teach me how to stay sober a day at a time. And I said, I don't need the meetings. I read the big book. I read the 24-hour book. I share my experience, strength, and hope with people I think will do them some good. What has happened to the towering ego? Not a thing. It's still there. It's still there. And I stay a loner for those 4 months. I did read the big book every day. I did read the little 24-hour-a-day book. And I did say a few things to some people that I thought were drinking pretty bad. But this same priest who loved me so much says, here. One day he walked up and he says, for your information, AA is alive and well in Cullman. Call this number. Now, who is willing to go to what lengths to get what you got? I wasn't. Here is a sober... You might say an Al-Anon type person, because he didn't know what Al-Anon is. He can find AA. He says, call that number. Every day after he said, call, I said, yeah, they don't answer. The third day, he said, what time do you call? I said, midnight. Now, I'm not proud of that, but that's the truth. You know, that's crazy. See, I haven't been cured. I'm still nuts. He says, go to the phone and call right now. Well, I couldn't do anything else. And I went to the phone, and I got my sponsor, the first sponsor, Juby. And Juby, you'd have to know him. What a beautiful man. Oh, Lord have mercy. And I said, Mr. G, this is Father Hilary out at the college. I'm an alcoholic and I need to go to an AA meeting. About that tone of voice. And there was this long silence on the phone, and I learned what realists, AA people, are. The first thing that man ever said to me over the telephone or any other place was, "Father, are you drunk now?" Which, of course, was the crucial question. But I said, "Of course not, you know." Well, he says, "It just so happens we have a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. I'll be along at 7:30 to pick you up." I hate to tell this, Nick. I said, "That's fine, Mr. G, but don't come to the front of the college. I'll meet you down on the road to the cemetery underneath the trees by the entrance to the grotto." You know, it's a wonder he didn't say to me, "Hey, Father, when you want what we've got and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, call me up and I'll come get you." But no, you come to Coleman and I'll show you the trees and the road to the cemetery and the dark of the moon where good old Juby came to pick up this drunk monk and take him to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I dread to think what would have happened. I wish I could tell you I walked up the steps over the pool room to the AA club room and it was glory, hallelujah, and the heavens opened up and let's go. It was awful. Oh, mercy. Had a room about as big as a broom closet. The plaster was coming off the ceiling. The wallpaper was coming down. There was a hole in the floor where they swept the dirt down on the next man. There was an old couch with springs coming up, one naked light bulb. I thought, "Oh, my Lord. There's none of my kind of people in here." See the towering ego again? Oh, Lord, have mercy. And all of them were foot-washing Baptists of Church of Christ. Wasn't any CID at all. You may call this a CID disease in the North, but it sure isn't in Alabama. Lord, have mercy. And I thought to myself, if I get out of here, I'll never come back again. I don't belong in here. This is sure not where I'm supposed to be. And I would have left then, but you see, I didn't have a car. And I was too lazy to walk the 2 miles home. But just as all this is going through my mind, this is the truth. At that door, here comes a lady. I knew this woman as a splendid Catholic matron, a big church worker up in Decatur. I didn't know she was an alcoholic. Her name was Rosemary. And she came out that door and she put her arm through mine. She really did. She said, "Come on in, Father Henry. You're right where you belong. We are so glad to have you. You'll be all right. You won't have to drink anymore. You're going to be okay. Come on in." I really get to whim my arms when I tell you that, because I don't know what would have happened in my pride, my ego, if Rosemary hadn't been there that night. And the amazing thing is that I was 2 years a member in good standing, that is, dry and sober, before they decided I was strong enough to know that that was all a put-up job. Wasn't any coincidence at all. After Juby hung up with talking to me, he called Decatur. And that conversation went like this. "Rosie?" "Yeah, Juby. Come down here to the Coleman meeting tonight. I need you." She says, "I can't come. I'm chairing my own meeting." He says, "I don't give two hoops in Hades what you chairing. You get down here. You're a Catholic. I got a Catholic priest coming in here. I know a damn thing about Catholics, much less priests. You're a Catholic. You get down here and you help me with him." Isn't that a gorgeous story? And with a stupid Catholic priest is stumbling through the doors of AA, who's there to put out the hay? Gee. Man, if that isn't a story, I don't know one that is. What'd I do with the clock? So that was the beginning. They put out the hand of AA, and I made every possible mistake there was to make in the program, except slip. By the grace of God, I've not slipped, at least not so far. But everything else that could have happened has happened to me. I remember asking them once, you know, what it's been like. We were sitting around the table on a closed meeting. And I said, "Now, I've been sober and dry 2 years. And what I want to know is, if I don't manage my life, who's going to manage it?" Now, again, there's this great silence over the group. You know, when the spirit's moving and they're waiting to see who's going to zap the fool again. And this time it was Juby. He said, "Well, Father, step 3 said made a decision to turn out, we all in our lives. And the step says, "Salt through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious conduct, praying only for..." I said, "Shut up. Keep quiet. Don't tell anybody I asked that question." Here I am, a trained theologian, an eminent divine, and I got to go to AA to find out my theology. Gee. You know, I knew that God at one time was supposed to run my life, but I'm convinced that alcohol brings with it a terrible, terrible kind of blindness. The big book says that there is a time when we can no longer tell the difference between truth and falsity. And I think this is why they keep saying to AA people, new people, go to the meetings. And the patient says, "I don't want to go to the meeting. What good is it going to do me to go to the meeting if I don't want to?" And a good sponsor says, "I don't know, but go to the meeting. Bring the body. Bring the body." This flies right in the face of psychology, what we think is good psychology. You know, most psychology says straighten out the thinking and the acting will follow. And AA says act as if. Bring the body. And we'll see what happens to the thinking. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. You know, you talk about marvelous. So there I was introduced to who was supposed to run my life again. Now, that's great. They let me teach one class. I'd been president of the college. Hired everybody, you know, signed the checks. Yeah, big time. Now I'm begging for a job. As our old coach used to say, be nice to the bat boy on your way up. You may see him again on your way down. I saw him up and down and back up again. Oh, Lord, have mercy. I managed to stay sober a day at a time. I came to be in love. I came to be in love with AA. Now, you can't be in love with a program. There's no way. Piece of paper. Nuts. You can't be in love with 12 steps. It is 12, isn't it, Andy Ruth? You can love people. And I came to be in love and am in love with AA people. The most marvelous people on the face of the earth, you know. And little by little, little by little. I remember the very first time that I ever made a speech like this. I've lost that clock again. There it is. I had a sponsor who was a supernumerary judge. I found out from our lady friend what that meant today. He's gone to heaven. But, he was rough on me. He was district attorney and he was my sponsor. And he'd say, he said a lot of things, but one of them was, he said, "There you go, acting like God again." He was always on to me about that. But one day, I guess I had been sober about 4 years. I believe it was 71, I'm not sure, maybe it was 3 years. And I got a copy of a letter that he had written to a man in Mississippi. It said, "Dear Woody, yes, Father Hillary will be glad to talk at the Mississippi State Convention August 22nd to the 24th at the Heidelberg Hotel in Jackson, Mississippi." Paragraph. "It doesn't matter where you put him on the program, because we'll be there from the early bird meeting till the last shot is fired." Paragraph. "I know, because I will bring him. Sincerely yours, Tom Pettis." By that time, you know, I had been so thoroughly brainwashed that if they told me to stand on my head in the corner and count to 10, I'd do it. But I thought, that's torn the sheep. I cannot go over in Mississippi and stand up in Bishop Giroux's backyard and say, "My name is Hillary Draper, and I'm an alcoholic." I can't do it. I just can't do it. You know, and that voice says, "You can't do it. You want to stay sober?" I say, "Yeah." "Well, then you better go do it. You better go do it." And so, you know, little by little, step by step. I think the last, I'm going to tell you two things more. I'm way ahead of time, doing good. My sponsor, and it was Tom, says, "I had to tell you this. I would really prefer not to." In 1972, this is over 10 years ago, the abbot of the monastery retired, and you may remember the news events that covered the election of the Pope, where the electors lock themselves up and go to pray in and vote for a successor. Well, the monks do the same thing. And with my track record, I had no right to expect anything. But the monks locked themselves up in August the 20th of 1972, and the rookies don't get to vote, but naturally they're very interested in what's happening, and When the vote was over, they ring all the bells in the monastery, and they have to stay to sign all the papers, but they send out word who was elected. And on that day in 72, Father Hilary was elected the seventh abbot of St. Bernard. And that's... And the reason, that's what these gold chains and the rings are all about. I'm bad news in the church. We went to say Mass this morning. You should have seen the pastor hopping, too. Fred knows. But I just smile, you know, and they want to know what I'm doing here. But what I want to tell you, this is the truth. The young monks get the word Father Hilary's been elected, and they're running through the halls of the monastery shouting all the way with AA. Isn't that gorgeous? And AA has taught me, you know, it's taught me how to try to be a good abbot. And the monks are marvelous to me. They're terribly frank. I think sometimes they're franker than they should be. They don't hesitate to come up to me and say, "You show all getting hard to live with. Why don't you go to a meeting?" I used to resent that, but I don't. I say, "Go to a meeting. Fine. I come home feeling a lot better." What am I like today? I'll tell you what I'm like. I'm trying to be me. I'm trying not to be somebody I'm not. I'm trying to be me. I have Satan responsibilities. The primary one, and every speaker here has brought that out, is I've got to stay sober. That's number one in my life. And I hate to say this. He didn't say it, but I'm going to say it. AA has got to come, if there ever is a conflict, and I don't believe there will be, but it's got to come even before my church business. I hate to tell it, you know, we have strict rules about getting to church on Sunday, but if it was a difference of my making AA this morning and getting to church, I'd have to say, "Dear Lord, I'll have to go to the AA meeting. You just have to forgive me to church." I really believe that the only thing that lets me function is Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I ever forget that, I'm starting down. I'm not going up. If you want to know what's happening in my life, read the promises. I'm not going to go through them for you. The steps, yes, I am still working on the steps. When we got through with step five, it said became willing to have God remove all these defects of character. And I wasn't willing to have them all removed. I got a few I like. And I'm sure if you examine your conscience, you'll find you've got a few you like too. But I'm getting better. I'm trying to let him remove all these defects. And then it said, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. In AA, I think sometimes at least me, I'm great about saying I'm going to do it and then don't do it. But I'm trying. I'm trying. Made a list of all the people we had harmed. Oh, man, I had a list that wouldn't quit. It started off with 60 monks. But the time came. The time came. I didn't force it when I was able to stand up in front of them and say, "I apologize and I'm sorry for all the trouble I caused in this house." The day was given to me. I think you have to find the right time. Read the big book again. It tells you that. Made direct amends to such people. Wherever there's some people who have not accepted the amends I've made, that's the cross that I still bear. There's some people who have just turned me off. And I there's nothing more I can do about it. I pray and I say, "Well, I have to accept it. I can't change it." I tried to make the amend. And they just turned, "Oh, Lord, it was awful." But, you know, you stay sober. You can't do anything about that. It says continue to take personal inventory. At night, thank the dear Lord. I say, "Who'd I hate today?" And if you do that every day, you can figure it out. It doesn't take you a long time. What you going to do about it? Tomorrow morning, I'm going to say, "I'm sorry. I was so nasty yesterday. I'll try to be kinder today." Or whatever. If you cheated at cards, go put the money in the poll box. That was for Satan people who needed to hear that. AA is evidently practical. The one I love and the one I really am working on these days is that one that said, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That's a great one for me. And it just, it works. It works. It says in the book, we will become able to make decisions that we don't know how we make them. We make them intuitively. We will find that God is doing things for us that we could not do for ourselves. And it's true. Try it. It really is true. And then it says, you know, try to practice these principles in all of our affairs after we've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. If you haven't had a spiritual awakening, I know where it's supposed to be. If you've been in this program a few years, you say you haven't had a spiritual awakening, come see me and I'll tell you. Your problem is you are dumb as hell. Excuse the expression. It's chronic stupidity. And your sponsor should be able to break through that for you after 3 years if you still haven't had a spiritual awakening. That's just my opinion, you know, and I'm entitled to it. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and I've had a spiritual awakening. The spiritual awakening for me has been, I think, basically this. And I got time. That I'm not any longer afraid to die. That sounds terrible. I know death is sorrowful because all separation is sorrowful. But I know this, that I firmly believe in the communion of saints, and I firmly believe that so many of those people whom I have loved dearly, like my original sponsor, and have gone before me, are waiting for me. And I know this, that if I go to God and they're not there, it will not be heaven for me. And therefore, that's taking the fear of dying away. There's just too many people I'm dying to see. I really am. Like Jimmy, you know? I just hear him hollering, well, it took you a long time to get here. Oh, Lord. The last story, and we'll finish right on the dot. How about that? So many great things have happened. I'm famous for saying in our group, stay sober and good things will happen. And the newcomers get so mad. They'll tell you after they've been there 8 months and good things have happened. They say, that big fat priest always saying, stay sober, good thing, and nothing good happening to me. But they stay, and it does, you know, and it does. It does. Even things that apparently look like they're bad when we get the right viewpoint. Really. But there have been so many positive good things that have happened to me. One of the best, I think, is that I had a chance to go to the Holy Land, to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. And that would never have happened to me if I had kept on with my drinking. It's a direct result of being in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you that I was in the Holy Land 2 weeks, and all I could do was weep. We went to Bethlehem, and we sang Christmas carols in July. You know, we had church services at the crib. All I could do was weep. And, of course, all the rest of us, one other AA there, he understood. He got his eggs around, and we all wept together. The rest of them said, what the hell's the matter with you? I said, you wouldn't understand. There's nothing wrong with honest weeping, and just go on, do what you want, let me cry. It was just absolutely unbelievable, unbelievable experience. The one that really got me the most was we went to Bethany. And if you remember from the scripture, there was a family at Bethany, two sisters and a brother, who were very dear to Jesus, Martha and Mary and Lazarus. And apparently whenever the going got real rough, he'd go spend a weekend, not at Hilton Head, but at Bethany with them. And Lazarus is sick. And it's most likely Martha who has sent the word to the hotshot preacher, who's been working miracles, by the way, that Lazarus is sick. And she expects him to come over there and do something about it. And he doesn't. In fact, he doesn't even get there in time to tell him farewell before he dies. And he doesn't even get there for the funeral. And this is the hotshot rabbi who's eating them out of house and home. You got to get Martha's understanding. She was a real Al-Anon mentality. God love you. And so he finally decides he's going to go. And Martha has buried him, and she has got one eyeball on the road. You read the scripture, it tells you. And she sees him coming, and she hot-foots it down the road. Now, no preacher ever reads that like it ought to be read. Because Martha's voice has got to be just scathing. She is just up to here with what she's had to put up with.
And she says to this rabbi, she says, "Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died." I mean, all the unfaith, all the resentment, all, it's there. It's there. And she doesn't realize that she nearly tore the sheep. That she's standing in the face of the Almighty, but she's also standing in the face of compassion. And he says, "Yes, I know. But thy brother will rise again." And all of a sudden, Martha's changed. She has that spiritual awakening. She says, "Yea, Lord, I know, on the last day." And then they go into the house. The relatives are still there, eating and moaning. And Jesus sees him and he says he wants to go out to the cemetery and see the grave. He goes out, but Martha's back in fawn. He says, "Roll the stone away from the tomb. I was right there. You ought to see it." And Martha says, "Roll the stone away from the tomb. He's been dead 4 days and he stinks." Ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that I certainly did stink, but I also know what Lazarus felt like when he walked out of that tomb. Thank you.